Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Greenhouse Gas Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 23, 2014, the Supreme Court issued its opinion in Utility Air Regulatory Group v. Environmental Protection Agency. The question in this case was whether the EPA permissibly determined that its regulation of greenhouse gas emissions from new motor vehicles triggered permitting requirements under the Clean Air Act for stationary sources that emit greenhouse gases, or GHGs. Justice Scalia delivered the opinion of the court with respect to Parts 1 and 2, which held that the EPA could not require a source to obtain a Prevention of Significant Deterioration, or PSD, or Title V permit solely on the basis that the source emits GHGs. The court also concluded, however, that the EPA could reasonably interpret the Clean Air Act to allow for the regulation of GHG emissions from sources already subject to regulation under the PSD and Title V program. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy joined the opinion of the court in full. Justices Thomas and Alito joined the opinion as to Parts 1, 2A, and 2B1. Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan joined as to Parts 2B2. Justice Breyer filed an opinion concurring in part and dissenting in part, which Justices Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan joined. Justice Alito filed an opinion concurring in part and dissenting in part, which Justice Thomas joined. The judgment of the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit was affirmed in part and reversed in part. To discuss these cases, we have Robert R. Gassaway, who is a partner at the law firm Kirkland & Ellis, LLP. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Gassaway.
Thanks to the Federalist Society for giving me this platform to discuss this interesting and important case. I am a partner at Kirkland & Ellis, LLP, and along with my colleagues Jeff Rosen, Jeff Clark, Bill Burgess, and Aaron Nielsen, we represented the Chamber of Commerce in the UARD case. Obviously, all the comments that I'll make today are on my own behalf and not those of the Chamber of Commerce or the Federalist Society or others. I'd like to start by running through four key takeaways that I get from the opinion, then go on to dispel three myths, and then to give a short preview of coming attractions. Now, just to set the background, that we're talking about the GHG case. And I think most people know that it's the first really big case in the line after the Massachusetts versus EPA case in 2007, held that greenhouse gases are air pollutants for purposes of the Act-wide definition in the Clean Air Act Section 302, and therefore that they're potentially susceptible to regulation under various Clean Air Act programs. The specific issues that the court decided on Monday had to do with the Prevention of Significant Deterioration program, which involves controls and permits for large stationary sources in the Title V program, which involves operating permits for large stationary source programs. And the controversy was joined because EPA had interpreted very aggressively certain statutory language under both the PSD and the Title V programs to allow it to pose a degree of burdensome regulation that was both deeper and wider in terms of number of sources than what had previously been experienced under those programs. The first key takeaway is just that the court sharply criticized EPA's overall approach to implementing the Clean Air Act. I think it bears heavy emphasis that the whole EPA approach, the whole EPA request for deference, the whole EPA bid to say we need a program that addresses and effectively controls greenhouse gases, and we should be given a lot of leeway in designing that program and redesigning it over certain statutory language was squarely rejected by the court. I think it bears mentioning some of the specific passages from the opinion, and I'll run through a few of those quickly. The court said, quote, it takes some cheek for EPA to insist that could not possibly give air pollutant a reasonable and context appropriate meeting that would have the programs work more as they had intended before. many on the call, I think, are familiar with the earlier Brown and Williamson tobacco decision that was expressly approved by the court on Monday. The court said when an agency claims to discover in a long extant statute an unheralded power to regulate, quote, a significant portion of the American economy, we typically greet its announcement with a measure of skepticism. The court said pointedly, since the statute does not compel EPA's agency-enhancing interpretation, it would be patently unreasonable, not to say outrageous, for EPA to insist on seizing expansive power that it admits the statute is not designed to grant. The court swatted away the authority that the Solicitor General had cited as his best case, Morton versus Ruiz, said that is, quote, irrelevant. The court stated, were we to recognize the authority claimed by EPA in the tailoring rule, we would deal, quote, a severe blow to the Constitution's separation of powers. And finally, the court stated, we are aware of no principle of administrative law that would allow an agency to rewrite such clear statutory terms, and we shudder to contemplate the effect that such a principle would have on democratic governance. These are very pointed rebukes by the court to the whole approach of EPA to its interpretation. So that said, what is the effect of the decision? And my key takeaway number two is the court could not have been clearer in announcing a category exemption for all small sources from PSD-based regulations of greenhouse gas emissions. That's no small thing. The court on page 17 of its opinion said, without some such holding, the number of sources subject to PSD in any given year could jump from 800 to 82,000. So the number of sources required to have operating permits on Title V could jump from 15,000 to, quote, about 6.1 million. But the court ultimately held that the PSD program and Title V are designed to apply to and cannot rationally be extended beyond a relative handful of large sources capable of shouldering heavy substantive and procedural burdens. So for all those thousands and millions of sources that were potentially subject to GHG-based regulation by EPA, either immediately or perhaps down the road as the program evolved, that's at an end. They will never, absent amendments to the Act, come under the PSD and Title V programs. My third key takeaway, and this may be the most important, is that contrary to some media reports, the court also set very clear and very significant limits on PSD-based GHG emissions controls for large sources. And there are a number of these, but there are at least five different limitations that EPA is going to have to negotiate on remand in order to effectively regulate large sources. And let's go through some of that from the language of the opinion. I think maybe the most important language in this regard is where the court says, we acknowledge the potential for greenhouse gas best available control technology controls. This is the case-by-case permitting under the PSD program, to lead to an unreasonable and unanticipated degree of regulation, and our decision should not be taken as an endorsement for all aspects of EPA's current approach or as free rein for any future regulatory application of BACT in this distinct context. And then it went on to talk about the petitioners, our side's worries that by allowing the PSD program and BACT controls to be extended to encompass GHG emissions, you would have EPA regulation of energy efficiency throughout the economy. The court, as to that point, said, assuming without even deciding, that BACT may be used to force some improvements in energy efficiency, there are important limitations on BACT that may work to mitigate petitioners' concerns about unbounded regulatory authority. And then it went on to run through some of those important limitations. Number one, there will be no fundamental redesigns of facilities. Number two, there will be no regulation of demand for energy from the electric grid. A friend of mine asked last night, could they regulate air conditioners? Answer, so long as the air conditioner is plugged into the grid, no, they can't make you have a more efficient air conditioner. Finally, there are two de minimis requirements, minor improvements in energy efficiency, such as light bulbs or for out. At most, you can only regulate the facility's equipment that uses the largest amounts of energy. And second, there's a de minimis limitation and requirement, not just on minor pieces of equipment within the facility, but minor emitting facilities themselves. So it says EPA may require an anyway source to comply with Greenhouse Pact, but only if the source emits more than a de minimis amount of greenhouse gases. And what is de minimis? The court says we do not hold that even 75,000 tons per year of CO2 equivalent necessarily exceeds a true de minimis level, only that EPA must justify that selection on proper grounds. Now, one key battleground on remand is going to be how do you measure de minimis? My partner, Jeff Rosen, has emphasized again and again that in terms of CO2 emissions effects, EPA has never really quantified the harms that it is preventing by the controls that it imposes, harms in terms of sea level rise or in terms of health and welfare effects or even, in some cases, of temperature rise. So the question is what unit of measure is going to be used to count what is de minimis or not? Will that be a unit of measure based on emissions, based on CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere, or CO2 harms? Depending how the court and EPA answer that question, the de minimis exception could really be very, very large. The one thing that the court did seem to endorse was a approach to carbon dioxide control that I'm not sure is going to play a very big role as a practical matter. The court said that carbon capture is reasonably comparable to more traditional end-of-stack backed technologies, the technologies that can be required by the permitting, and petitioners do not dispute that. I think that's correct. I think we could not dispute that an end-of-stack technology like carbon capture is most analogous to traditional back technologies. But the problem in the CO2 emissions context is just I'm not sure how practical that is for any kinds of large sources, either large industrial sources or large utility sources. My fourth and final key takeaway is the court expressly invited follow-on challenges to EPA's large source regulations in future proceedings. So even after crafting all of those limitations, really on its own initiative, the court didn't stop there. It went on to make a couple of reservations in footnotes that suggested that there may be a second opportunity to come back and to make some of the arguments that were made and rejected in these proceedings. Let me just quote those two footnotes. The first one is footnote 9, where the court says the possibility that the PSD program's site-specific air quality analysis requirement may be inoperative as to greenhouse gases does not convince us that they must be categorically excluded from BAC, even though they indisputably are pollutant subject to regulation. We are not reviewing EPA's guidance as to what is and outside of BAC in these cases, and we cannot say that it's impossible for EPA and state permanent authorities to devise rational ways of complying with the statute's directives in the future. So it may be too early to say that there's no rational way to implement BAC, but they're not precluding that. And then finally, in note 6, the court runs through some possible limiting constructions on the PSD trigger, and it says they've been proposed, including one that would limit the air pollutant subject to BACs to, quote, air pollutants with localized effects only on air quality. We do not foreclose, says the court's EPA, or the courts, the lower courts, from considering those constructions in the future, but we need not do so today. So even after putting forth and establishing all of the limitations for large sources that I just discussed, the de minimis limitation for specific equipment, the de minimis limitation for the facility, the no regulation of electricity consumption from the grid, the no fundamental design, the must be reasonable limitation, even after announcing all that, it comes back and says, even with all that, we're really still not even sure that you can go forward and have a rational program, or maybe we're still not sure you can have a rational program, except in the instance of carbon capture and of stack technologies, which really don't play a very big role anyway. So with those four key takeaways, I think we're ready to quickly and easily dispel three myths that you may have heard from media coverage. One is that the decision was a fractured decision. This was not a fractured decision. All of the rules and principles and language that we just reviewed was adopted, embraced as holdings by a majority of the court. It's true that that majority shifted and waxed and waned depending on the specific part of the opinion, and I won't go into that. But at least five members of the court joined every part of the opinion. There were no plurality parts of the opinion. And some of the key limiting language, including the reasonableness language I began with, was actually joined by seven members of the court, all but two members of the court. So this was not a fractured decision. This is a majority decision in all aspects. The second myth that you may have heard is that this was an EPA win or something closer to split the baby. I really do not see how you can say that. In terms of the principles involved, the interpretive principles involved, it's hard to think how EPA could have been rebuked in more uncertain terms by the court. In terms of the expansion or potential expansion to small sources, it's hard to imagine how it could have been rebuked more definitively. And even as to the large source question, which the court might have ducked and allowed EPA to deal with in the first instance on remand, it's hard to imagine a more extensive warning to EPA about the clear and significant limits that it will have to operate under on remand, together with even leaving the door open to the possibility that even all of those limits may not be enough. I know that lawyers have a hard time ever not looking at the bright side of the decisions of the cases that they're involved in. I may be subject to that. But as I have stepped back and read and reread the opinion over the past couple of days, this seems to be a very, very significant defeat for EPA. And I'm really not sure what, as a practical matter, of their current large source program remains in effect. It seems to me they'll have to go back to the drawing board. The third myth that I've heard from time to time, less often than the myth that EPA won, is that it was a muddled decision. I can see that point of view to a certain extent in the sense that I do think that there is clear language that says for the time being we're allowing EPA to go forward with large sources subject to these clear and significant limitations, whereas there are the two footnote reservations that I think pull back on that a little. So to some extent, I can see there being some tension in there. But in terms of the overall thrust of the decision, and aside from the footnote reservations that are often ambiguous in these sorts of cases as to scope, I really don't see the muddle. So briefly to wrap up, we'd just like to offer a potential preview of coming attractions. And one is just to remark that I think this does open the door to a policy and political discussion among the branches, among EPA and perhaps with the legislative branch and our congressmen getting involved as to how the PSD program should be shaped for GHG emissions going forward. I think before the people who are most involved in those discussions, and I'm certainly not one of them, but I'm relying on colleagues for this, report that those discussions were cut short by the idea that EPA was required by the current Clean Air Act to regulate GHG emissions under PSD and other programs. I don't think that interpretation of the Clean Air Act survived Monday's opinion, and I do think that it may and hope that it will provoke a more wide-ranging discussion at EPA and among Congress about how the BACT and Title V program should be applied to GHGs. And the second issue going forward is looking at the wider proceedings that are going on under Section 111, the NSPS issue, potential petition for rulemaking under the NAAQS provision. I think that there are two clear lines of argument that the court has laid down in asking, as it asks itself, whether any particular Clean Air Act program can accommodate GHG emissions controls. One has to do goes to whether the particular program can sensibly regulate the type of pollutant that GHGs are. And the other goes to whether the particular program can reasonably accommodate, as a practical matter, the types of controls that would be needed to effectively limit GHGs. And you could see in Part A of Monday's opinion, the first type of analysis, and Part B, the second type. And I think that that opens the door to the application of those two limitations on EPA authority under the new source performance standard, under the NAAQS standard, and I think those could be very significant going forward as EPA seeks to control GHGs under programs under the Clean Act, Air Act, other than the motor vehicle program that is already in place.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.